Raconteurs News.
Good evening and welcome to Raconteurs News on this November Tuesday evening. We've got something pretty special lined up for you tonight. I'm Andy Young as usual, and tonight we're also going out on our new media platform, which if you haven't checked out already, I'd love you to check it out. It's autonomousmedia.net, and as of the 27th, we'll be discontinuing our Spreaker account, so that's where you'll need to go for the live shows and the chat room. As usual, I'm joined tonight by my regular co-host, Jason. How are you doing, Jason?
I'm very well, Andy, and how are you, my friend?
I'm all good, mate. Yeah, just so excited about tonight. It's a very special day. As our listeners, I think most of them will be aware, but some might not be. It's 53 years ago and about 3 hours ago that John F. Kennedy was shot in a very public display in Dallas. And tonight we have a real friend of the show. We stream his shows. He's known as the Blind JFK Researcher. Welcome back to Raconteurs News, Chuck O'Shelley. Welcome, Chuck.
Hey, Chuck. Well, hey, it's great to be here, guys. You know, today is one of those days where I do focus on the assassination. This was my starting point for getting involved in radio, for getting involved in, well, alternative or whatever, honest media to the best of my ability anyway. The fact is that this is the jumping off point, folks. Why? Mm. Why? You know, look, I found it remarkable because I told a couple of people that I was only going to do one show today. I might make an exception if a guy who's got like 400 radio stations, you know, domestically here in the U.S. calls upon me. But outside of that, I told everyone else outside of you guys that I'm not going to go doing presentations today, because normally I would be filled with the whole day. Please be part of our panel. Please be part of this. Because it's one of those things that although a lot of people are aware of it, they haven't taken the time to study it in depth and understand the significance of it. A lot of people say, as I know Andy is going to want to talk about this first, what is the significance of this more than half a century later? Right?
Oh, exactly.
I mean, don't you hear that question?
Yeah, whenever I bring up Kennedy, the first thing that most people say these days is, look, it was half a century ago. We know we've been lied to. We know we're never going to get the truth. What the hell is the point in harping on about it? We've got more important things to look at. But I'm not sure that is really the case. What do you think, Chuck?
Well, it depends if you want to just battle the disease or you want to get to the root, right? And this is one of those events which absolutely exposes the root of the criminal conspiracy. Now, when I say criminal conspiracy, I'm not talking about a specific group of individuals occupied with one particular aspect of our lives. Is it just perpetual warfare? Is it just the poisoning industry, which, you know, feeds us the GM foods? Is it just the chemtrails? Is it just? No, this is one of those pivotal points in history where if we understand it, if we're able to dissect it properly, we will understand everything that is still going on today. Because here's what happens, and this now I mark this as my opinion before I get into facts. My opinion is that this was the last representative in the office of president in the United States that actually believed he wielded power. I believe that the last man to challenge the CIA directly might have been Richard Nixon, which they punished him because it was way too soon to put a bullet in his head, okay? They got rid of him by, well, what do? They marginalize, they scar you with scandals, they basically call you on the carpet for doing things that other people have already done, and that's something that we call what? Watergate.
Listen, sorry, Chuck, just wanted to interrupt you, and before we really get into the JFK thing totally, regarding recent events in America and the election, I mean, we were on your show on the night before the election, and we were all pretty certain that we're going to be Hillary Clinton. What have you made of what the result has been, and what do you think the ramifications are?
Well, believe it or not, this puts this event that we're going to talk about today in even starker contrast to the reality that we're dealing with now. Because in my estimation, people have been sold hope and change once again, just like they were when this Barack Hussein Obama took office, if that is his actual name. The thing is that when this guy took office, a lot of people, certain segments of our society in this country, were led to believe that something was going to change. What we had is a continuation of the system's domination. We had a continuation of the subjugation of our people. We have had greater surveillance. We have had extrajudicial executions. We have had no improvements. Even let's just throw the 500 or 5,000 pound elephant right out of the room immediately. The idea that Barack Obama was going to do something for black people because he was black also goes way the hell out the window. Nothing changed. This guy is another puppet of the system. And guess what? You've been sold it once again. The disenchanted people who believe that something could be done via the introduction of a reality TV star into the system, you've been sold down the river again. Don't anybody confuse that with the idea that I think Hillary would have been a great idea in the office. Here's the bottom line. It's irrelevant. It's a puppet post, and that's it. It is there to keep you distracted. It is there to do nothing but actually damage in reality. That's the only thing that our presidency does at this point in this country, and as soon as Americans can wrap their minds around that, we might actually get something done. None of them, anyone who is selected, not elected, and I'm not the first person to call it a selection, that's for sure, but I stress it all the time. A former president did that almost a century ago when he said presidents were selected. Can't remember which one it was, but I do think it was one of those guys whose names you'd recognize. Okay? Anyway, look it up. If you don't believe me, just enter that into a search engine. Fact is that as we look at the diminished system, as we look at the non-representative, allegedly constitutionally represented republic in this country, which is a fallacy and a farce in and of itself, let us consider that this was the last legitimate president that we're talking about. And if we can wind it back and see exactly where the will of the people was completely stolen, you know, it had already been stolen incrementally over time. Let's not fool ourselves. But the last vestiges of that reality were removed on November 22nd, 1963. So I put all this in context. As far as Trump is concerned, though, hold on to yourselves because it's going to get real ugly and it's going to be real interesting because the finger pointing is not going to be at the establishment when it happens. It's going to be at you, the American public. And I don't mean you like the listeners right now, but I keep saying this to my fellow countrymen, allegedly, that it's going to be at you. You wanted this. You got it. And it's really just a continuation of the system with new packaging and new BS attached to it. That's really what's happened.
Well that just about sums it up in a nutshell. I think that there's a lot of people clinging on to a lot of false hope. And I think what they've done is this time is last time it was everybody was caught on. Everybody, all the liberals were caught up in the change element of what Obama was saying, and then even 4 years later, when it was quite apparent that this Nobel Peace Prize winner, who'd not overseen a day of peace in his entire tenure,
excellent point. Yes,
he sort of caught the liberals with the change vibe, as it were, the tagline of change. Do you think that it's just been flipped this time and people that and natural conservatives that seem to have been disenfranchised by the Obama administration and do you think that they've been sold a pup with Trump much the same as the liberals were with Obama?
Yeah, well, see, you know the phrase black or orange is the new black, right? Popular series, popular notion, cutesy thing in pop culture. Okay, I'll tell you what happened here. Orange became the new black, or black became the new orange. Yeah, it's just that simple. They told you what was going to happen. As crazy as that sounds, that's what happened here. You know, like I said, they repackaged it. Of course, I'm making a joke about the spray tan that Donald Trump has and all that. But bottom line, we're looking at puppets of the system. We're looking at people that are going to perpetuate or exacerbate the thing that has kept us enslaved through its surrogate mechanisms, through its direct mechanisms, and through the illusion that you had a choice in the first place. That's what the reality is, and you're exactly right. They sold the peace-loving president, who got a peace prize, although he's presided over more wartime activity than his predecessor. We've got the guy who swore up and down before he got into office he was going to give us transparency, when he's classified more documents than any of his predecessors. We have gotten the man who was supposed to be understanding of the racial divide because he is allegedly biracial. We got this guy presiding over one of the most tenuous problems we've had in this country, one of the most ridiculous problems we've had on the streets of this country, involving the politics of race since the 1970s. What are you telling me, or what am I telling you, and what did George Orwell explain to us, right? We got double speak, double thought, and we got it all coming back on itself, so it's really gone into quadruple as far as I'm concerned, and it's really getting exponential, bottom line. So that's it. You've been sold another bill of goods, and enjoy the show. That's all there is. You want solutions? Fine. We can get to solutions, but these guys have nothing to do with it. Not a single damn one of them. That's the way it goes. It's us. It's we the people who are supposed to be represented by this government, just like in many other corners on the planet. We the people are supposed to be on top of the power structure. They work for us. It's not us abrogating our own responsibilities to them. It's not us acquiescing to their will. They are supposed to be executing our will. And we need to keep that in mind. And if it's not working, what's it time to do, folks? Anyway, as I said, when I put it in context with this, there was still some semblance of a possibility that we might be represented by our government. There was still a guy who said, you know what, even though the military-industrial complex wants me to invade a place like Cuba, although we have just been on the brink of nuclear war with the other alleged superpower on the planet, despite the fact that publicly we were told they were competing with us on a technological level, they were not. Despite the fact that it was not necessary to invade a place like, well, let's get into it, Laos, okay? Let's get into, let me think for a moment. There was possible military conflicts in Laos, Cuba, Vietnam, various parts of Indonesia, all of that which they called Indochina, and a lot of people itching to make bank on it. That was what was going on from 1961 to 1963, which was the short presidency of John F. Kennedy, which was cut short by this public execution. Now, did Dwight Eisenhower warn us publicly about the military-industrial complex? Sure he did, right on his way out the door. This guy knew. This guy knew what was coming, and it did come. And yet, a guy like Kennedy was willing to go out there and make statements, not only just flippant remarks on Twitter, because it didn't exist at the time, but actually make public statements to the world that the world heard that the possibility of eliminating all weapons, eliminating war itself, cooperating in the exploration of space, these kinds of concepts were coming out of his mouth. And believe it or not, just like there was no problem with Martin Luther King Jr. being a rabble-rouser on the level of race politics in this country on the streets, that was acceptable because it added to the politics of pressure that could be played. The moment that this man used his influence to speak out against those who were aching to accelerate and pushed the war in Vietnam, this is when he took a bullet to the head. And that's exactly what happens. Bobby Kennedy, same thing. Malcolm X, who said, I got no reason to go kill a yellow man when I'm still confronted with a white man who is not giving me my rights. Another man who took a bullet in the head. And a list of individuals whose names are not accentuated. The destruction of various activist individuals who wanted to give you the idea that we don't need to fight the wars that benefit only the bankers. We don't need to fight the wars that benefit only the weapons manufacturers. This was a time when this kind of thing happened, and as far as I'm concerned, the first shot was fired, not only in Vietnam, but really in the war on us and on our conscience and the people that would publicly stand up and speak to it when President Kennedy was killed. Not saying that this man was a perfect, godlike person. I'm not one of those guys who tells you that Kennedy was a great guy. He authorized covert actions that I find reprehensible. He was definitely a cold warrior, but he was evolving in his understanding because as he got into the inside, he actually understood that the game was loaded, folks. And this is what ended that day. So if you don't mind, I do want to get into that unless you guys have some other commentary you want to get from me. Or you want to challenge or criticize what I just said, by all means.
No, for me, Chuck, I'm quite happy for you to go into as much detail as you want. As you said, you don't normally cover this subject, even though it's the subject that got you started and you're really passionate about it. I just want to give you free rein and let you go where you go. If we get questions from the listeners, which you did say you'd enjoy answering listeners' questions, then we'd be more happy to fit them in as and when we can.
No, absolutely. And Jason, you know, I don't know if you have any other ideas or whatever, but I think that it has grown even more important in its context. I think that the reality that we wind up studying here when it comes to the assassination of our 35th president needs to strike home even harder, considering the alleged 45th president that is taking office now. And as we watch all the things that are about to unfold, I think that needs to be considered. If you got something else you want to add in, I'll give one more comment on that and then get right down into the subject itself.
No, I think we're great to go straight into the subject itself. I mean, there's that many tangents of that we can go down. But I'm interested in what you've studied far more than I have. So I'm interested in what your conclusions are, what your research has brought you to.
Well, you know, it's interesting because over the years many things have happened. I make this last commentary regarding, you know, look at our modern times versus, more than half a century ago. Let us consider this, that at the time that Kennedy was president, the use of a single word, and still today this is possible, the use of a single word on the international stage at that time was critical in the trajectory of events. The use of, and here we go, we'll go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis once again, which some people complain that Kennedy might have laid the groundwork for unintentionally, that particular tension, which brought us to the brink of nuclear war in 1962. Okay.
Did the Bay of Pigs incident happen? Wasn't that blamed on Kennedy? Was it an absolute disaster, and didn't they blame that on Kennedy?
Well, the Bay of Pigs is a separate issue, but it does tie together to all this. I'm glad you bring it up, so I'll address both. The Bay of Pigs thing happened virtually right after Kennedy took office. It was a prearranged plan that the CIA already had in hand, okay? And it was ill-formed. It was completely ridiculous, the idea that they were going to land 1,000 guys on a beach and create a popular uprising on the island of Cuba. It was the worst-kept covert operation secret I've ever seen, and it was set up to intentionally fail, to provoke military action. How do I know that? Because the coffee-stained notes of Alan Dulles himself have seen the light of day now, and this seems to be what he was working on. All right, and Alan Dulles, Charles Cabell, and a few others who were in the hierarchy of the CIA were asked to resign shortly thereafter, and they did. They weren't fired directly. Everybody says they were fired directly, but they were strenuously requested to resign and did so. And if anybody doesn't know anything about Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles and the involvement of the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency with one another, I urge you to go ahead and look into that area of study, which we won't have time for today.
Well, it was. I mean, the old Cuba thing was quite. There was a lot of involvement, a lot of shady things going on with the Cuba thing, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. On multiple levels, we come to find out later in the 1970s that. You know, Kennedy himself, but also other administrations, had signed off on assassination attempts on Fidel Castro. Now, Castro survived them all, okay? This is where the mafia comes into the equation, because they were asked to join in the plots because, well, the CIA will hire anybody to achieve their goals. There's actually something that I've gone over on my show before. And seems like a lot of people don't know about it, but the CIA actually printed a manual on assassination where it states right in there that criminals and any undesirable individual is fully eligible to be hired by the agency in order to conduct their business. Okay. I urge you to go look that up too. Interesting stuff for sure. And it's just amazing to me really that it got committed to paper. Okay.
And so, a little bit like around about the same time, Operation Northwoods. I mean, that it's an amazing thing that got committed to paper as well. But that's something that Kennedy rebuffed, and he got did he not sack the whole Joint Chiefs and the head of the Joint Chiefs, Lionel Lemnitzer, was it who authored Operation Northwoods? Was that around about the same time? And do you think that had an effect on what happened to Kennedy in the end?
I don't think that it had an effect on Kennedy, that particular piece of paper, but it is rather fascinating that this was offered to Kennedy and he refused it. And, of course, he did reorganize the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a result of Northwoods, because it was so crazy. For people who don't know about that, that came out as a result of the Assassination Records Review Board work, really. In the 1990s, and it had to be declassified. Now, there's still a ton of stuff that hasn't made the light of day, but there have been over 5 million documents. I think something like 6.5 million, in fact, documents that have seen the light of day as a result of that. But presidents are presented with contingency plans and possible plans all the time. Northwoods, in a nutshell, just the highlights real quick, they were going to attempt to stage false flag events directly without using that term. But listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a plane load of students, allegedly, and we're going to blow it up near the island of Cuba. And then we're going to blame it on Cuban terrorists in order to justify military action and to further justify the sabotage and assassination program, which was already underway. Okay, what does that sound like? Oh, by the way, another highlight, this was going to be done with a remote control plane. This was offered by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the 1960s. Now, for those that want to scoff at the idea that 9/11 could have offered us scenarios where planes were being controlled remotely, I urge you to understand that the Joint Chiefs of Staff would not have offered a possibility to the president that they couldn't pull off.
Yeah.
So if they could do it in 1963, tell me they couldn't do it 38 years later.
Well, anyone who doubts the ability to remotely control huge passenger aircraft like that, perhaps do well looking up Field McConnell. Field was 30-odd years a military and airline pilot, and his father actually took part in the testing for Boeing in the 1950s of four-engine remote control bombers. But could you just sneak in there before we go any further, Chuck, and just say we've got a lot of listeners who appear to be stuck in our lobby of our chat room. So anyone who's got logged into chat but you can't see the other people who are chatting, if you get the sidebar up on the side for the chat with everybody's name in it, at the top of there you'll see AM chat room with a little house symbol. If you click on that, that will take you directly into the chat and you'll be able to relay any questions or join in the chat with the others. So thanks for that. Over to you, Chuck.
Well, here we go. We've already covered a lot of the rabbit trails, let's just say, that you wind up running off on regarding this one particular event. Ready? This stems from less than 10 seconds, no matter who you speak to. I think it's closer to 6 or 7, but the debate goes on between whether it was 6 seconds or 10 seconds in Dallas. Of course, the famous book title is called 6 Seconds in Dallas. I tend to believe that we're looking at 6 or 7 seconds for an event. It is the most covered, most written about, most discussed event in world history, as far as I know. I don't think that any literature pool out volumes it. Okay, this is independent literature, combination of, you know, mainstream stuff, the government printing office stuff, all of it all put together. I don't think that one particular historical event has actually had more written about it or spoken about it than this particular event. So, here's the thing, though. A lot of people don't even understand the basic facts of the case. Okay, so I'll go through the textbook understanding just briefly, so bear with me 30 seconds for those of you who've heard this a million times. Just after 12:30 or so, depending on who you speak to, Central Time, which is Dallas local time, all right, on November 22nd, 1963, right after John F. Kennedy had gone from Fort Worth, Texas to Dallas, Texas and landed at a place called Love Field, he got into a motorcade, okay, and while making a trip through the streets of Dallas on his way to a trademark speech where people were waiting for him, he was killed. He was killed in an open limousine. He was killed in public with anywhere from 150 to 450 tangential or direct witnesses to the crime. No live broadcast was made of the assassination, regardless of what anybody tells you, and I've even interviewed people who swear up and down that they saw it happen live on television. The events themselves were not memorialized in that way. There are home movies that exist. I contend that there may actually be a government film of it. This is not a conspiracy theory. I base it on the fact that a documentary was made, and in fact, that is what most of the stock film that you see during documentaries comes from. This was made by a government agency, a Navy photographer, actually, and it was the only professional-level filmmaker in Dealey Plaza that day, memorializing the trip. Okay? So there may actually have been a piece of film at one point in time that depicted this much better than four films that actually depict the headshot. The Zapruder film, everybody's heard of. The Nix film, you might have heard of, made by a man called Orville Nix. There was also a film made by a lady named Marie Muchmore. And a third film made by a gentleman named Bell, who shot it so poorly that it took a great deal of enhancement to understand that the headshot had been memorialized. These films are motion pictures. There are a few stills, but only one seems to have captured the headshot, and that was taken by a lady named Marianne Moorman. This is a Polaroid. If you're not familiar with the Polaroid concept of a camera, this is the reality of the film evidence that we have at this time that is known publicly. There are many other films of the motorcade. There are many other films of the aftermath of portions of that motorcade from that day. Something like 35 films, actually. If you piece them together, you can almost follow the motorcade from beginning to end. And that means that you could begin with the stuff done by CBS at Love Field, and you could end with a film of the car rushing under the triple overpass and coming toward the filmmaker. That man's name was Jack Daniel. Anyway, the reality is that this happened. He was shot at least twice. We know, based on official reports, that was a minimum of the amount of, well, the amount of wounds that had to have been accomplished on his body. That's a minimum. Also struck in the firing was a man named John Connally, who was the governor of Texas at the time, and it was sitting directly in front of John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, wasn't he caught by the magic bullet?
Well, we get into the magic bullet, then we get into other areas.
Okay, well, all right, well, we'll just leave it. We'll carry on then.
Well, yeah. You know, there's we can stop and go through these things, and it's not a problem. But there was a third man wounded that day, and it wasn't a severe wound. It wasn't life-threatening. John Connally's wounds were life-threatening, and I'll get into John Connally. But there was a third man wounded that day, which caused a problem for the official conclusions. His name was James Tague. He was struck by something on the face. Now, that something seems to have emerged from either a portion of a bullet or a portion of curbstone, which was displaced by a gunshot. Problem is, of course, Mr. Tague is, I think it's 120 feet ahead of the car at the time of the shot that may have struck him. All right?
Okay. Is that the deaf mute guy?
No, sir. No, sir.
Okay. Sorry. Okay.
That's a different gentleman. I'm not sure what to make of his story, but we can get into him too. I'm talking about James Tague, who passed away, I believe, in 2013 or 2014. But I had spoken to many times. He was actually at the Triple Underpass at the time that Kennedy was shot, watching the motorcade. He was a car salesman and this kind of thing at the time. And, like I said, just passed away a few years ago. But the thing is that the fact that he had been struck changed the government's story right away. So going back to John Connally, again, the governor of Texas, who is struck also, here's the fascinating thing. There are seven wounds, okay, entrance and exit, I count as separate wounds in this discussion, entrance and exit, seven wounds attributed to a single bullet. The defenders of it will call it the single bullet theory. Arlen Specter, a few years before his death, started going around and telling people it was the single bullet fact. This has been distorted by people who support it and people who discredit it. I am here to tell you something that's very unpopular. Is it possible that a single bullet could have done the damage that the government contends? Yes, it is. It is actually mathematically possible. There's a problem, though. We have no evidence to support that the conditions required to do this are there. We could begin with the gun. We could begin with the inaccuracy of the weapon. We could begin with the fact that they claim that that Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin, who I have not brought up to this point because I am not convinced killed anyone. But let's get into it. The idea from the government's official conclusion in 1964 was that he had fired a bullet which had passed through Kennedy's back. Okay, wound number one, out of his throat, wound number two, into Connally's back, wound number three, okay, then, in its trajectory, by the way, they claim that this thing passed through Kennedy's back and neck, out his throat, right, without having struck any intermediary bone or anything like that so that it could not be deformed or deflected. But let's put that aside. It strikes Connally in the back, wound number three. Then it smashes, its fourth and fifth rib. I mean, basically pulverizes the fifth rib into shards and definitely breaks the fourth rib on its way through Connally's body. Exits just under his nipple, okay, that's wound number four. Enters into the top of his wrist or the bottom of his wrist, depending on who you're talking to.
I'm thinking back to the movie JFK, and in that when they talk about this bullet and then it comes out from his ribs, then doesn't it linger for like 1.5 seconds in the air and then enters his wrist?
Now that's actually a misnomer. The problem is when you try and compare it to the Zapruder film, that gets into another area. Let me finish with the list of wounds real quick.
Yeah, sure.
It exits under the nipple, as I said. This is wound number 4. Enters the wrist, either top or bottom. Wound number 5. Exits the wrist after breaking it, shattering the bone and severing the radial nerve. Okay. And this is wound number 6, the exit. Entering again into John Connolly's leg, where it comes to rest. All right. And that is wound number 7. This bullet, according to the government's explanation, somehow was dislodged from Connolly's leg at the hospital, winds up on a stretcher, and is collected in not pristine condition, but damn near undamaged condition for a bullet that's been fired through anything. Okay, there are minor deformations to it, but it is ridiculous to assume that this thing could have done what they said the bullet did. So there's the problem of the bullet itself. The trajectory, remotely possible, but we don't have anything to support it in way of what was being filmed at the time. The positioning of the president would have had to have changed in a strange way in order to make it work. Is it theoretically possible? Yes. But then we go back to the weapon. What you have here is an untenable story all the way around. Okay.
Uh-huh.
The fact is that Connolly was wounded in all the ways that I just described. Okay. That has been, I've talked to some of the doctors that were in attendance. Okay. So I know for a fact that they dealt with these wounds and also, performed life-saving procedures on John F. Kennedy, despite the fact that they knew there was no way to salvage this man. His brains were blown out. They did it so that they could never, ever be blamed for the idea that if only the doctors had done the right thing, okay? So they erred on the side of trying to do the right thing, which caused them to trach him and everything else and do all that they could to save him, but he was dead. There was no way to retrieve him. Anyway, but all of those wounds, and we still haven't even talked about the head wound, have we? So here comes that minimum second shot I talked about, the head wound, which, you know, famously is memorialized on Zapruder's film 313 because the frames of the film were numbered. So on film on frame, excuse me, 313, we see the explosion of the head. We see the head shot. This is the minimum second bullet that had to have struck Kennedy to achieve the wounds that are observable not only in the films, but in the x-rays, the photographs, and by all witnesses, this is the minimum that had to have occurred. 3 shots, according to the government. We now have a missed shot because of Mr. Taig. So therefore, 2 bullets had to accomplish all of this, and this is why the magic bullet comes into play. Because at this point they had to explain. At first they had 3 shots, and they had 3 shots based on the fact that there were 3 spent cartridge casings. And there were many witnesses who did state that it sounded like 3 shots, although some said 5, some said 7, some said 2. This kind of thing with eyewitnesses is typical. It happens all the time, and you don't know what they were paying attention to or what they took it as or what their experiences were previous. So let's put the eyewitnesses aside. At the end of the day, we know that the man was struck at a minimum of 2. We know that Connolly was struck. We don't know how many times, in my estimation, but official explanation says with this very same bullet that passed through Kennedy's back and neck. So this is the official explanation so far, okay? And, of course, he did not live. And adding further complication to that is, gee, just 49 hours later, Lee Harvey Oswald is killed in police custody by a man named Jack Ruby, the alleged assassin. Despite the fact that there was a basement full of police officers and they were doing a transfer and there was media eyes on it and it was broadcast live on television.
Was it normal practice in those days for something? I know that these were pretty extraordinary events, but was it normal practice for, like, maybe a criminal to be transferred from police station to court and for it to be on TV or at least for media to be there?
Well, it was not standard practice. We didn't have the 24-hour news cycle. You had your nightly news, And on occasion, they would get a film of this, or they might get a film of a dog in a tree. It didn't really matter. Obviously, you know, Oswald was the most famous alleged criminal on the planet at the time. So media coverage, descended upon Dallas as quickly as possible from around the world. All right. Yeah. So this is a unique circumstance. That's for sure.
Didn't know whether it, at that time it was standard practice for when a prisoner's being transferred from a police station, which I'm assuming he was going to a court building, for there to be access allowed for the media, rather, because in these days the it's particularly over here in the UK that you don't get to see a defendant at all.
Yeah, much of it is at a distance. It was not standard practice to do this. He was actually being transferred from the holding cells in the police station or the Dallas safety building there, which was pretty much like the city hall, if you will. He was being transferred from there to the county jail, okay, so that he could be held over a longer term. And no, normally you would not see this stuff. A bus would come along or a police car would just take you on over to the jail. That was it. They actually armored car. Yeah.
We were in such extraordinary circumstances that people didn't really question that, did they? That, you know, why are all those people there?
Oh, no, not at all. People didn't question it because everybody, I mean, if you look at the films from that weekend, you'll see that the Dallas police station was fully overrun by media people, onlookers, local citizens. They had no idea. They were fully overwhelmed. In fact, here's the funny part. You know who's hanging around that whole weekend in the Dallas police station is Jack Ruby. Yeah. And caught on film by CBS, NBC, and even during the what they call the midnight press conference on Friday at midnight, right before they hauled the judge out of bed at 1:30 in the morning to formally charge Oswald with the murder of the president, guess what? He's answering questions, and in the back of the room is Jack Ruby. Now, later on, District Attorney Henry Wade, which, yes, Henry Wade is the same guy from Roe versus Wade, interesting district attorney, many of his death penalty convictions having been overturned after his regime left office because he railroaded people and was a completely corrupt prosecutor. But anyway, the fact is that district attorney Henry Wade is holding a press conference trying to give the facts to this huge plethora of media in front of him, and he says something like, well, Oswald might have been part of the Free Cuba movement or something like that. Okay, I don't know. You guys ever seen this piece of film?
Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure I've seen it, yeah.
Okay, so he's corrected very quickly by, it sounds to me, and I make this assertion on my own, but I know other people have observed this before. It sounds to me like more than one voice chimes in, but one of the voices chiming in to say, actually, that's the Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
That's
one of those voices is Jack Ruby.
So for people that perhaps don't know, who was Jack Ruby? I know he was a nightclub owner, wasn't he, in Dallas. Was it Dallas? He was a nightclub owner, or was it New Orleans?
No, he was a nightclub owner in Dallas. He owned the Carousel Club. Yeah, the Carousel Club was his place.
He had a lot of police clientele, didn't he, and stuff like that. Looked after the police and everything, but he also had mafia connections as well, didn't he, Jack Ruby? He was a very complex man.
Very complex man is a very good way to put it. A hothead of sorts. Somebody who threw people out of his own, and the Carousel Club was a strip club, but he threw customers out himself a lot of times. He was just this kind of guy, very tough. This is not an Italian gangster, but somebody who was associated with Italian gangsters, including the Campeses, who according to all accounts pretty much ran Dallas at the time. One of the few people who visited him in jail was one of the Campese brothers. Not a famous mafia name, but if you know your mob history in America, you'll know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line is he's tied to Chicago mob guys. and was allowed to operate a lot of things that were, you know, not necessarily legal at the time, some things in the gray area, and some things directly illegal in Dallas. You could have only gotten away with that without getting your place burned down with the agreement from the local mob guys, which he had. And you very accurately point out the fact that he knew virtually every police officer in Dallas. In fact, of the 70 police officers that I can identify that were present when Oswald was killed, I would say that a minimum of 50 of them knew Jack Ruby personally, by name, by face, etc. Okay? He served sandwiches to these guys. He gave them bottles of booze, according to his bartenders. He gave them special treatment, free stuff. He would show up at the police station with food and presents and, well, we've heard lots of stories about cash, but nobody really wants to verify that's still breathing. Okay? So this is the kind of guy he was. He was connected. He's not like a mob boss. A lot of people make him into a mob boss. He's not. But he certainly had connections, and he was certainly operating in that world. Yes.
No, but he was portrayed as a local business owner that was so outraged at Kennedy's assassination that he took it upon himself to get Lee Harvey Oswald. That's right, isn't it?
Oh, at the time, yes. And the mythos for many years is outraged and patriotic club owner Jack Ruby decided that he needed to do this because he wanted to spare, get this one, folks, he wanted to spare Jackie Kennedy the trauma of having to return to Dallas to testify. Now, some people might say, why the hell would Jackie Kennedy have to return to Dallas to testify in the murder of her husband? Another little-known fact, at that time, it was not a federal law that was in place against the assassination of a president. This is a local crime. Everybody forgets that.
Mm-hmm.
This was under the jurisdiction of the Dallas police. Mm-hmm. To this day, in fact, as we speak right now, it's an open homicide on their books. You know why? Because nobody's been convicted of it.
Uh-huh.
So it's an unsolved crime on the Dallas police blotter, period. That's what it is. And that's all it, you know, can be until evidence is produced or a suspect is convicted to close it.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I like to throw that one out there because when we see that, you know, the FBI is immediately demanding that evidence is shipped to Washington, when we see that there's all sorts of contacts in the media that are saying the FBI says this, the Secret Service says this, whatever said that, why didn't the CIA get involved? The truth is that the policing agency responsible for the investigation should have been and always was and still is to this day because you can't go back and retroactively change it. Even though there was a statute in place against killing a park ranger, there was no federal statute or law that governed the murder of a president. It was a homicide committed in the city of Dallas, in the county of Dallas. Therefore, it was their problem. Okay? Nobody remembers that, but good point, I think, to make.
Was that the same situation with Abraham Lincoln? I've no idea about the Abraham Lincoln assassination, nothing whatsoever. I'm just asking that just basic question.
Well, that's kind of an odd situation there because you get into The laws were fully different at that time, too, but I guarantee you there was no, you know, there was no technical thing specifically about murdering the president. Because
okay.
If we didn't have it in the 1960s, I don't think we had it in the 1860s. Although, interesting thing to point out when we look at these two things, not just the symmetry, you know, Kennedy's, you know, primary secretary was named Lincoln. Lincoln's primary secretary was named Kennedy. By the way, all that kind of interesting coincidence and all that. Another correlation to draw here is that when people talk about, well, someday they're going to have to declassify the documents, you know, hold on to yourselves. today, as we speak right now, there is still classified documentation related to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow.
And there was no CIA then, and the Secret Service was not involved in presidential protection. We're talking about different agencies, and still to this day, there are hidden facts related to that assassination. I'm not as well studied on it, but I do know that. So
we've covered Jack Ruby, haven't we? Not entirely. I mean, his involvement is like, you know, it's the tentacles everywhere. It seems that he's got some hand in different pies and different areas and different organizations that would benefit from President Kennedy being no longer the president.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And, of course, you know, for somebody who is not necessarily caught up here, we are talking about the guy who winds up walking into this display of Oswald being transferred, literally cuffed to two officers of Dallas, two homicide detectives. In fact, one of them named Graves and one of them named Lavelle. You know, the famous guy in the white hat you see making that face and turning, that's Officer Lavelle. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to him personally. he's an interesting guy, but he saw Jack Ruby coming and just did not know what was going to happen. And voila, we have this guy pumping a bullet into Lee Harvey Oswald's stomach while he's cuffed to two officers. Really a curious way to assassinate somebody. And his motives, Jack Ruby's motives, are still in question to this day.
Do you think Lee Harvey Oswald knew what was coming? Because him and Jack Ruby were quite well known to each other, weren't they?
Well, I believe that that there's proof enough to say that they knew each other.
Yeah.
I don't know how well. And for those that speculate that he saw Jack Ruby coming that day and everything else, he did not. I'll tell you why. There are lights that the TV stations brought and put overhead. And I know what these lights look like. I know exactly what they were, and they were all on. And believe me, Oswald didn't see anybody step out. If anything, he might have seen a shadow. He would not have recognized Jack Ruby. I promise you that.
Okay.
But the thing is, did he know that Ruby was going to come for him? I don't think so. I don't think so because it's just very weird circumstances. And to this day, by the way, nobody can really properly explain how Ruby got into the basement unless you decide that one of the police officers who was guarding the only entrance that Ruby should have been able to use is a complete liar. That's the only way you can get him in there, that he saw him, let him go, and never even to his death spoke about it. I have a theory regarding how he might have gotten in.
Well, I mean, if he knew 50 of the 70 officers that were on duty on the day, then there's a very good chance that whoever was guarding on that day and at the gate and letting people in would have known Jack Ruby, and it wouldn't have taken much, I don't suppose, for Jack Ruby to just say, here you go, take this and let me in, please.
Exactly. And I think the best way to have done it, because of the way he appears on the film, because I've looked at the film uncut, not just the shot of him shooting him, but I've looked at the raw footage. The way he appears and everything else, he's there, you know, with full knowledge of when Oswald's coming out, because he's only there maybe 30 seconds or a minute or 2 minutes before Oswald comes out that I notice him. And it seems to me as though, you know, with the cameras that were on outside that didn't capture him, that he probably came through the stairwell and came around the back. And this is why a lot of people didn't see him at first, you know. But that's a whole other interesting area of speculation. And here's the problem with all of it, is whether it's Oswald's murder or Kennedy's murder or the circumstances of the actual crime itself, we have so many more questions than we do answers. because so much of it is unverifiable any longer. And quite honestly, there's been more damage done by speculation than by looking directly at the evidence itself and trying to establish what makes some sort of logical sense out of it. I'd love to leap to a lot of conclusions. I'll give you my favorite bad conclusion, and that is that I would love for George H.W. Bush to be present in Dealey Plaza that day. I really would love that, because it would just be wonderful to be able to crown the Bush crime family with this one. But it falls apart when you examine the evidence properly, you know. Anyway, I know you guys are going to a break.
No Herbert, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Not in Dealey Plaza, sir.
Not in Dealey Plaza. All right, okay. Fair enough.
Okay, well, this is the time we normally play a tune, Chuck. So we've got a load of questions that I've been copying out the chat room ready for you. But in the meantime, we'll just play a quick tune that my wonderful wise woman, Luby, she's been trawling the net and found some really appropriate songs. So we've got this one from Lou Reed. We'll be back in just over 4 minutes.
I dreamed I was the president of these United States. I dreamed I replaced ignorance, stupidity, and hate. I dreamed the perfect union and a perfect law undied. Most of all, I dreamed I forgot the day John Kennedy died. I dreamed that I could do the job that others had done. I dreamed that I was uncorrupt and fair to everyone. I dreamed I was in gross or base, a criminal on the take. And most of all, I dreamed I forgot the day John Kennedy died. I remember where I was that day. I was upstate in a bar. The team from the university was playing football on TV. Then the screen went dead and the announcer said, "There's been a tragedy. Unconfirmed reports the president's been shot and may be dead or dying. Talking stopped, someone shouted what? I ran out to the street. People were gathered everywhere saying, did you hear what they said on TV? And then a guy in a Porsche with his radio hit his horn and told us the news. He said the president's dead. He was shot twice in the head in Dallas, and they don't know by whom. I dreamed I was the president of these United States. I dreamed that I was young and smart, and it was not a waste. I dreamed that there was a point to life, to the human race. I dreamed that I could somehow comprehend that someone shot him in the face. John Kennedy died. Oh, the day John Kennedy died. Oh,
John Kennedy died. Oh, the day John Kennedy died.
My name is Michael Obenicia, and I'm the producer-director of The Great British Mortgage Swindle, and you're listening to AutonomousMedia.net.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And welcome back to Raconteurs News. And this is our JFK anniversary special. And tonight we're joined by the amazing, the man who proves that it doesn't matter how much jello you throw in your swimming pool, you still can't walk on water. It's Chuck O'Chelly.
Okay. So that's the new second hour bumper on my show. And I got to thank Muddy for that, because that's extreme. I don't know. I found it funny, that's for sure, so hopefully you guys do too. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just listen to somewhere around the middle of my show. And when I begin the second hour, that's what Andy's talking about there.
I just like to listen to the bit when the White Russian turns up.
Oh,
hello there, Choco Chili!
Yeah, it's that White Russian. Have you found out who it is yet, Chuck?
Actually, I believe I know.
Oh, well.
Know, but I'm not going to reveal it just yet.
Well, if he's a great guy. He cracks me up. If he wants to call into other radio shows, you could tell him he's more than welcome to call us anytime.
Yes, he can call in here and I will be Black Russian and we can talk together. We can be tovarish.
Well, I'll tell you what, the next time he calls in, I promise you I'll pass that message along. I saw you guys post on Facebook at one point about it, I think, on your on Raconteurs News Facebook page. And he's only turned up twice on the show so far, but pretty funny stuff, yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, there's nothing more guaranteed to get Sherry's witch's cackle out in full form, is there?
Oh, absolutely. She goes nuts. I don't know if you guys noticed, but I mean, the past two times that he's called in, when he started talking the first time, she was fine. But then you could hear her in the background just exasperated. Oh, God, I don't believe this. Yeah. Like, you could hear it just in the background. She's got her head turned, doesn't realize her mic's on. I love it. And then when he called in the second time, it was great because she heard him and went, oh, no. I heard that, you know, in my headphones. I don't know if everybody else did, and I just went, yeah, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
You're getting a babushka from Sherry. Ah, yeah, Chuck O'Chelly.
Oh, man. I
I am Black Russian here in Britain, Great Britain.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, back to the JFK special. I nearly said 9/11 special. What the hell was going through my head there? We got quite a few questions posed in the first half, Chuck, so if I could just read a few of those out. There's Sturm and Mithrin are on pretty much on the same subject. Sturm asked, what is Chuck's real opinion of Judith Mary Baker? Is she important? And Mithrin is asking, does Chucky have an opinion on Dr. Mary's monkey? Which I'm pretty sure you do, because I think you've mentioned it once before with us.
Okay, Dr. Mary's Monkey, we'll start there, was written by Ed Haslam.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book. It's an interesting book, that's for sure. Now, I do think that Ed did some very good work when it comes to the first version of that book, which is called, I believe, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus.
Yeah.
I think that he revealed some things about the character of David Ferry, who comes up in the Jim Garrison investigation, who, in case you've only seen the JFK movie by Oliver Stone, was played by Joe Pesci in the movie. I believe that he did some good work there. I believe he makes some interesting connections, Ed Haslam. Now, where it gets strange is this. Judith Baker, and I'm going to make a very rough statement here tonight, and this is the kind of statement I don't make about a lot of people, but I am willing to defend this. This is not the view of Raconteurs News. This is not the view of anybody else on this show. Judith Mary Baker, in my estimation, is a fraud. Period. Okay? I'm not going to be nice about it. I'm not going to be calm about it. That's what she is. And is that a legally actionable term against me? Yes, please, by all means. Judith Mary Baker, haul me into court over calling you a fraud. I want you to produce proof that I'm wrong. I want you to do that because in order to lodge a claim of fraudulence and to claim damages because I've called you a fraud, you will have to do so. Do it. How about that?
That's fairly unequivocal.
My opinion.
That's fairly unequivocal, Chuck. I think everyone got your definite, honest opinion there.
Okay, now why? Now wait a minute. Let me back it up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. Why do I say this? Is it just my opinion because I find the thing distasteful? No, I'd love to believe her story. I'd love to believe her story. The problem is that when somebody like Joan Mellon interviews 1,200 people, okay, when she interviews 1,200 people connected to New Orleans, connected to Oswald, connected to the Garrison investigation, and there is no way that Judith Berry Baker was ever cited anywhere, okay, in proximity with the players, when she makes assertions that on the face of them are ridiculous, okay, including, well, gee, you know, there's a description of how Oswald is dyslexic. She describes him behaving in a certain way, which doesn't match, okay? Mm-hmm. She's factually been inaccurate about a bunch of things and, quite honestly, is not taken seriously by any scholarly investigator in this case. That's what I'm telling you now. The premier expert on this case, in my estimation, is a guy named Walt Brown. He is the best living expert on the Kennedy assassination, period. All right? 30,000-page chronology he published a few years ago in 2013 on the case. I mean, literally taking us from when the Kennedys come to America to today. All right? Or should I say to 2013? How about that? He has co-written an article with me explaining how ridiculous her assertions are. Friends of Oswald's from Russia have privately and in some cases publicly explained how ridiculous her characterization of this individual is. The fact is that her assertions about working with Oswald in certain places, certain circumstances that emerge, are provably false. The reality is that at some point she may have brushed up against this guy because they did work at the same coffee company together in New Orleans, dispatched by a temp agency to do so. This is real. Mm-hmm. I believe this to be factual. I believe that she was in New Orleans for a time. But the rest of her assertions are all questionable at best, and I do believe that overall she is an absolute fraud. And in addition to that, you know what? You spend a few months during a summer with somebody like David Ferry, and you can produce a 500-page book about it a half a century later?
Mm.
Well, anyway, point is, that is where I stand on that, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. So what else have you got?
No, that's cool, Chuck. We've got a question from Kevin Mark, who is a great friend of Raconteurs News, and Kevin's just recently started investigating JFK. He's been really busy with helping a lot of people with warrants for gas and utility companies, trying to break into the house and fit prepayment meters. Does a sterling job on that, but he's branched off onto JFK, and he seems pretty convinced that LBJ was involved, because he's posted, when the motorcade came down the plaza, LBJ can be seen to be hiding low in his seat in the car before JFK was shot. Any thoughts on that one, Chuck?
That's based on reports. Mainly the photographs that people have put out there explaining that, mm-hmm, you know, are out of sequence. Here's the reality about Lyndon Baines Johnson, and I adhere to the concept that that Lyndon Baines Johnson is a criminal and really a sociopathic, nasty customer. Privately, when we even take a listen to the tapes that he himself made sure were recorded and are now sitting at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library, this guy was a despicable human being. For him to have been involved in this, however, I disagree with most people. I tell you that a lot of people have tied this directly to the character of a guy named Mack Wallace, who is allegedly, according to the narrative, the real shooter on the sixth floor of the school book depository, first of all, right? The real shooter from, well, maybe not even the sixth floor, but how about just somewhere in the school book depository, because the fingerprint turns up in the depository that has been alleged to be Malcolm Wallace's. Now, Malcolm Wallace can be connected to Lyndon Baines Johnson. So a lot of people for many years thought that this was his personal assassin sent there. The reality is that a lady named Joan Mellon commissioned not only a fingerprint expert, but a guy who trains fingerprint experts, who is certified, who is who has absolutely impeccable credentials to go over the evidence as it stands. And the reality is that fingerprint does not belong to Malcolm Wallace. I had her on my show regarding her new book, which is called Faustian Bargains. And the fact is that Lyndon Baines Johnson was corrupt. Malcolm Wallace is not a boogeyman, definitely a complex and interesting guy who was a convicted murderer. This is true. But not the assassin of JFK. And in my estimation, the LBJ thing, he didn't even benefit like a lot of people want to say. Yeah, he became president. But effectively he had one term of his own. Mm-hmm. And 3 years after leaving office, he died a broken and rather, you know, financially he was in good shape, but he was a broken and nearly psychotic man by the time he died in 1971.
Okay.
So I don't see him benefiting in the long term, and he did not have the pull to do some of the things that have been done here regarding the obfuscation and the evidence, and many other operations that I believe have taken place based on the evidence produced later. So although Johnson's a criminal, he was accepting money from mob sources, he was making side room deals, he was absolutely involved in influence peddling, insurance scams, scams against the agriculture department, criminal activity on all levels as a senator and as a vice president, not the architect of the assassination. To my knowledge, and new evidence could possibly emerge that would change that. But as it stands, no.
Do you think that the people that killed Kennedy, do you think that they did it with the blessing of LBJ, or do you think that they sort of said to him, you know, because I believe he knew it was going to happen, and I think it does allude to that in the Oliver Stone film. So do you think that he sort of said, look, if you're going to do this, yes, I'll give you your wars, because I think that's the word, the line that they use, get me in office and I'll give you your wars, just before JFK was taken out. So do you think that he was party to it at all, or do you think that he knew that it was going to happen, but he'd been backed into a corner, he'd sort of been told, well, you know, we can always get rid of you as well?
Now, I think you're looking at a willing accomplice after the fact. When you take a look at the JFK film, it's remarkable how much was correct in that film, but you also must remember it was a dramatization. That line where he's saying, you know, get me in office and I'll give you your war, or I'll give you your damn war, actually, in that movie, that was something that he said after the assassination that was recorded, that statement. It's a paraphrasing of a statement that was made, but it's virtually the same. And he's talking about, yeah, put me in office in 1964, okay, which wouldn't happen until a year after the assassination. Okay. It happened in between. But look, the idea here and what you're getting at, I believe virtually the same thing, that somebody went to him and said, listen, get ready, because you're going to be president. And, here's what we need you to do. And I think all they had to do is say, don't worry, your friends are going to make money. Kellogg, Brown, and Root is going to make money, okay, which later on turns into Halliburton, by the way. Check that. Yeah. All of that, your friends are going to make money. The people in Texas who are part of the military-industrial complex, all of your buddies are going to make money. Your buddies in the oil business are going to make money, and you're going to get plenty of slush funds for you. So be ready for that. You're going to get the presidency you wanted, because you always did want to be president. You're going to get more money, more access, and, you know, you're going to be untouchable. So I think by not even saying anything, you know, he was a criminal accomplice after the fact and more than happy to accept, you know, what he thought was going to be the benefits of this guy being removed. So I think somebody probably tapped him on the shoulder and said, basically, get ready, man, you're in next. And it's going to happen real soon. So I think that's what happened, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So he sort of acquiesced to that and he sort of knew that what was coming along. He wasn't part of it. He wasn't party to it and party to any of the planning or anything, but he knew what was coming along and he knew that the likely outcome that he could be president if he just played ball.
Well, yeah, and he wasn't the only one either, Jason. Here's the thing. National Security Action Memorandum 263. This is an order by the president, and it gives policy for what the national security state and the military are going to be doing. All right? National Security Action Memorandum 263. Guess what it said, and it was signed in October of 63 by Kennedy. It said that we were going to remove all American personnel from Vietnam by the end of calendar year 1965. This was an order signed by John F. Kennedy. Within days of Kennedy's death, Johnson signs National Security Action Memorandum 273, which virtually reverses all of that and commits us to further incursions into Vietnam. This is before the Gulf of Tonkin and all those incidents come around and all that. And here's the remarkable thing. If you trace the documents properly, National Security Action Memorandum 273 was being written while most of the cabinet was on a plane on its way to Hawaii, en route to Japan. Nobody knows really who authored it, and it was being written while Kennedy was still breathing. And it was signed by Johnson like Monday or Tuesday of that week when Kennedy was killed on a Friday.
So much like the Patriot Act, which came out not long after 9/11, which is sort of a month later, which was impossible to write the Patriot Act in that time. It's obvious that did you say it was a memorandum? It was already written, ready for LBJ to sign after Kennedy had been taken away.
Right, right. And in short order, you know, and we had executive orders back then, by the way, but in short order, not only does he do that, which reverses the Vietnam policy before the Gulf of Tonkin ever happened, which is another messy situation and crap that supposedly justified, you know, military involvement in Vietnam. Before that ever happened, this was signed in. And you can look it up. You can read them yourself. National Archives has them available. But what does he do exactly a week after John F. Kennedy is killed? Well, the president's, I love it, you know, the president's commission, okay, we all know is the Warren Commission now, but the president's commission on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. 1 week later, Lyndon Johnson signs Executive Order 11130. That is the order that formed the Warren Commission. And we know about that now, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so real quickly, this guy puts us, you know, puts us in a position of reversing Kennedy's policies, of changing up what we're doing nationally, and giving us the best cover-up commission, well, that money could buy at the time. Of course, the 9/11 Commission learned from their mistakes and didn't bother to even release their ridiculous evidence. They just gave us the report. But the Warren Commission gave us a report, too, 888 pages, a prosecutorial brief on an unconvicted alleged assassin, namely Harvey Oswald. So meanwhile, what else happens in this country? Well, through the sympathy of the fact that Kennedy had been killed, a lot of things had been passed. You know, Johnson is credited with civil rights acts and all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
But really, this was stuff that was authored during Kennedy's time and was pushed through because there was a sympathetic Senate and House that wanted to see Kennedy's policies enacted. And a few other of, you know, Johnson's alleged programs, you know, the Great Society and all that other nonsense. That stuff gets pushed through, too. But the only reason why that happens is because, well, he's got some buddies that are going to benefit. And that's what he's all about, is graft and, you know, organized criminals, but hey, they wear crappier suits. That's what politicians are. And LBJ was definitely, pawn scum morally anyway. So that's really what it comes down to. So what else do we got?
Yeah, you nicely covered that one, Chuck. Thanks. Now we've got one from Freeman Jack, and Jack's always got something, a little bit of a curveball. This is something I've not heard of before. He says, has Chuck seen the comparison between alleged photos and videos that suggest it was all a staged event?
Yes, I've seen the comparisons, and I would have to believe that 30, I'll give a low ball number. I would have to believe that 25 people that I have looked at face to face, spoken to myself, and interviewed myself are crisis actors in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm talking about eyewitnesses who definitely saw the event happen. This concept of some people say that it was a completely staged thing and they swapped out corpses and all this other madness. No, I think this actually happened, folks. It did happen. And we can argue about the various things that might have occurred and might not have occurred. And we can compare eyewitness testimony against forensics, which, by the way, we didn't even touch upon the forensic solutions which have emerged in recent years that are different from not only the official conclusion, but also throw quite a monkey wrench into a lot of people's conspiracy theories as well.
Hmm. And we've got one here, and it's from Ken over in Spain. And the question is very short and sweet, just like Ken himself. He's asking, did the kill shot come from the storm drain?
Okay. Now, here's where we run into a problem. It's a short and sweet question. But the storm drain, I would need to know something. There are two different concepts about this. There is this idea that there was a storm drain which is at the level of the curb, and some people assert that a shot was fired from there, from street level up into the car. This is untenable based on the evidence. It's also untenable based on the circumstances, the ability to move around in this thing. Unless you're contending that somebody basically held a handgun out of a sewer drain, okay, which you would normally see on the ground, and fired a perfect shot up into Kennedy's skull, well, you've got other problems with it, too. But that's virtually what you'd be asserting, because sticking a rifle down there doesn't work. The line of sight doesn't work properly. This doesn't work. However, if we're talking about the storm drain, which is by the triple overpass, this is not necessarily a place where an assassin fired from, but actually matches up with a lot of scientific evidence, which has been taken by individuals who are not part of the official explanation here. This actually lines up and could be the potential spot where a shooter did fire from the front.
Mm-hmm.
I said it, from the front. Not the grassy knoll, not the school book depository, at least not for the headshot. From the front, folks.
What was in front, though, obscuring that shooter? Was it from the overpass, you mean?
It would have obscured the shooter from most lines of sight. The storm drain that was over by the triple overpass. It's also an excellent escape route. Why is it that they didn't find a guy wandering around with a gun afterwards? Because he went down the storm drain. It would have made sense. And at that time, underground in Dealey Plaza, this guy could have, a potential shooter, this is my supposition, could have escaped exactly that way. Now, why am I saying shot from the front, though? This is an interesting question, which nobody is probably going to get time to ask. Forensic techniques, which were developed only maybe 10 years ago, when utilized to examine the medical evidence as it stands, which is in poor condition, by the way, the photographs, x-rays, and the autopsy report itself are an abysmal failure of forensic pathology. They're absolutely disgusting. But if one examines them based on modern techniques that only emerged beginning in 2003, 2004, which means that the perpetrators who altered these things and all these other interesting assertions would not have known about it. Okay, people? The thing is that if you take a look at that, you've got Kennedy's headshot coming from the front.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where it emerges from. Sherry Feaster writes a book, and she was a blood spatter analyst and worked in criminal forensics for many years. She has had it peer-reviewed by others, and no one has come forth with the credentials in that field to challenge it. Maybe some are not supporting it, but nobody has come forth and said that she's wrong. This book's been out for a couple of years, and it's called Enemy of the Truth. She lays out exactly how the headshot could have only come from the front. Not the grassy knoll, not the book depository, not the Daltex building, the front, which is a good place for that storm drain to be. So, I'm not saying that that's the solution. I'm saying that this is a whole hell of a lot more plausible than what people often, go after. And again, we didn't even get into the possibility that there were many more shots that were fired. We didn't get into the possibility that there could have been multiple shooters and all this other stuff. I don't like to expand it too much, but I will tell you that I do believe a shot was fired from the grassy knoll and missed. Not just based on the acoustic evidence, but based on the fact that somebody picked up a bullet and disappeared it from the opposite side of the street. And there's a lot of evidence missing, by the way, in the case. But anyway, what other questions do we have, Andy?
Okay, that's cool. We've got Kevin has brought up a couple of little things. He's saying he's curious about the comment that Jackie made when she went to see John in the mortuary, and she said, "That looks nothing like my John." And also, we've got Freeman Jack saying, "If it happened, the driver did it."
Okay. I'm laughing at the driver did it. Give me a minute on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me dispatch with the Jackie Kennedy thing. First of all, when she saw him, she was in a state of shock. I don't think anybody will argue with that. The woman held on to a piece of the man's skull for like 20 minutes before she even approached doctors and tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Will this help?" and handed it to them. Okay. She was inches away from her husband's head exploding. All right. That, coupled with the idea that, quite honestly, I don't know, maybe you guys have not seen a lot of dead people in your time. But I will tell you this, quite often when you see a corpse, whether they've been made up by a funeral arrangement place or not, you often have difficulty relating them to the living, breathing person you once knew.
Yes.
That's not uncommon. You know.
Absolutely.
And I've known a lot of people who have passed away in my lifetime, and I've got to tell you that even me personally, I've observed that. Okay, my eyesight sucks, but I've heard it from individuals who have no motivation to say anything like that and no reason to question it, but they'll say, "I just couldn't even think that that's the same person." The human body changes when it's not alive, no matter, and then they put makeup on it too.
I'll give testament to that, Chuck, because I found somebody that I knew. I found somebody that I actually knew that was. I found them dead, but I didn't know it was them. I didn't know it was them until they'd been identified.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, and we're not talking about somebody who started to decompose significantly either, right? I mean, nope. They just
no. Nope.
Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. You know exactly what I'm saying, and I tell you, ask anyone else about that kind of thing. You'll find a disparity in recognition. So not unusual, not a problem, makes sense, actually. Now, on to the driver shot him as I hit myself in the head. this thing was popularized by a guy named Bill Cooper, and we do remember Bill Cooper as a radio broadcaster in America, that's for sure. He was a shortwave guy. He was on regular terrestrial radio. He was on the internet, and he talked about a lot of great things that needed to be spoken about. And I'm not going to disparage Bill too badly here, but I will say this. His copy of the Zapruder film was crap. If you look at it, it's washed out. It's in terrible shape. I got a copy from Bill Cooper himself, and I got it on a VHS tape. The year, I'm pretty sure, was 1990, but it might have been 89. I was a kid, and I used to be a tape trader. And you had to pay Bill Cooper $50 American to get his Zapruder film and a package of other information. I got it from the state of Arizona myself, looked at it myself, and I've seen a forensic copy of the Zapruder film. I know what the problem is. It's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. The driver did not shoot Kennedy. It's just not there. Now, if you want to say that the Zapruder film has been completely fabricated and everything else, I need another 2 hours to argue with you. Mm-hmm. But, and I will say that it's been tampered with. It has been tampered with. I don't think anybody can dispute that it's been tampered with. Even the official explanation has to say that there's been some tampering. There's been frames removed.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen the entirety of the alleged original film, which doesn't just contain the small sequence in Dallas, by the way. You know, I've seen the film that he shot, the test film earlier in the day. I've seen, you know, some of the family stuff. I've seen the uncut version of the Knicks film. The driver is not your shooter, folks. It's a misunderstanding based on a bad copy of the Zapruder film. That's all it is. Nothing else.
Okay, thanks for that, Chuck. And we've just got two more questions. And the first one is from Mithrin, and he's saying, in Chuck's opinion, how many seats in the presidential limo? I think that's possibly going down the Mandela effect route. Yeah. And the other one is from Stone Lee, who's joined us for the first time tonight. He's only just heard about us. And he's asking, what about time travelers from the future coming back to change the past to make the future right?
Well, you know, Stephen King had a hell of a time with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could say that the possibilities are endless and we could shape reality. And who knows, maybe somebody will go back and erase that event. That would be kind of cool because I would be able to do something else with a lot of time I invested over the course of a couple of decades. And, hey, if somebody out there listening has the capability of doing it, by all means, go ahead and erase it. The Mandela effect and the amount of seats and, you know, the human memory is not a recording device.
Mm-hmm.
We need to understand this. It is a means of memorializing, but it doesn't mean that it maintains its integrity. It's constantly subject to new information. Okay. You put something on you might have done this yourself. You film something on your phone that you witnessed with your own eye, and you'll see new things on it on that phone. It could be anything. It could be a traffic stop. It could be a birthday party. It doesn't matter. And if you put it aside for a couple of years and let your memory play with it and then play it again, you'll see new things again, and things will pop to your memory that weren't there before. Memory is not a hard and fast recording device. It just isn't. So the Mandela effect, for the most part, I dismiss.
Mm-hmm.
However, the possibilities of time travel, the possibilities of things being outside of the linear idea of existence, I accept that those are possibilities, but I haven't seen substantial proof enough. Now, I do see something else in the chat room right in front of me. The full stop idea, the limousine, all this stuff. Well, the full stop on the limousine is something that I dismiss based on the fact that for many years, there were people that were there, again, eyewitnesses, that reported things that no other eyewitnesses reported. There are things that, for instance, Bill Newman, who, if you don't remember, and if you ever have looked at any of the stock footage, once again, Bill Newman is one of the guys, is the guy, actually, laying over top of a toddler on the grassy knoll area, next to his wife, Gail, okay, laying over another child. They're shielding their children from shots they believe are being fired, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He was probably the closest witness to the headshot, or one of the closest witnesses, without fail here. He's definitely not more than the third closest witness away, okay? And he reports Kennedy jumping up for years, all the way up until 25 years later, would tell anyone that listened that Kennedy jumped up, stood up in his seat. No other eyewitness reported that. Okay? Mm-hmm. Again, memory is malleable. Other information is added. All right? A drastic movement now memorialized by Bill, who was, you know, immediately interviewed, by the way, on Dallas TV and stuff like that. You can see it. Him and his wife, both with those two toddlers sitting on their laps in a TV studio. I believe it was WFAA TV. Fact is, memory is malleable. Other information is added moments after, years after, when new information, when a film is showed to you, when other researchers and people questioning you about an event press on certain questions, you begin to question your own memory. This is a fact of reality. If you study eyewitness testimony just about in any circles, you'll understand that it is subject to manipulation. Whether it be benign or malevolent, it's subject to manipulation. The full stop thing, I believe, comes from the fact that it was very slow. And you can find evidence for the brakes being applied in the existing Zapruder film. The brakes were applied. The car definitely jerked to a very slow motion during a critical moment, but didn't come to a complete stop. At least I've never seen the proper evidence given for that. So, anyway, and by the way, I have seen another cut of the Zapruder film that has not been shown to the public. I've seen a couple of films, actually, that have not been shown to the public. And there's more information in those films, and I'm sure that's why they're not being shown. But the full stop thing, that goes into a whole rabbit hole that that I don't believe is proper. And we don't need this. In fact, we don't need any of that to prove that there is, first of all, a conspiracy, which means the official explanation is wrong. We don't need a lot of the alteration in the evidence to be right or wrong in order for us to understand that we've been had and who the guilty parties are, I believe. But listen, study it all. Study it all. Examine it for yourself. I do a whole series of these shows called JFK Myths, where I dispel a lot of the things that don't have tenable evidence to support them. I'm open to correction from anybody who can provide me with something solid, tangible, and logical. But generally speaking, you know, and that's again our problem with Judy Baker, who was episode 3 of Myths, by the way. That's the problem here, is that there's a lot of speculation with either no evidence or badly interpreted evidence in a lot of cases. So, I know I've spoken long-winded about it, but I felt it necessary to get that out there.
No, absolutely. Chuck, the more detail we can give, I think the better that is for everyone concerned. Mitterrand is really not letting you get off that easy. He's really after a number of seats in the presidential limo.
Okay, number of seats in the presidential limo. Here is what I understand. There is a bench seat in the back, and I know that from the photographs that I've studied, FBI and Secret Service photographs taken, not just the films and the people positioned there. But there is a bench seat in the back. This is where Jackie and John are. There are two what they call jump seats, which are smaller seats, in front of them. One of them has John Connally on it. The other one has Nellie Connally on it. Okay. In the front, As per a Cadillac of that build, you've got the two Secret Service agents. Now, I am not sure right at this very moment if that's a bench seat or if that is two separate seats. But there are two Secret Service agents seated in front. So you have a seating arrangement that could hold more people, but you have four people seated in the limousine. So what else do we need to know?
Four people
as passengers that were not Secret Service agents plus two Secret Service agents.
Right, so the six people in the limousine, we're talking about people, because I know this is something that Mithrin and I have disagreed about before, but so there's two people in the front, a driver and a Secret Service agent, then there's Governor Connolly and his wife, and then there's JFK and Jackie in the back. So there's six people in the limousine. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
There's one other passenger that winds up on the limousine. Mm-hmm. That's Clint Hill. He's a Secret Service agent who ran from the follow-up car and climbed onto the back. And most famously, toward the end of the Zapruder film, you'll see him, although he claims that he pushed Jackie into the seat, it appears to be as though Jackie retrieved something off of the trunk and went back to the seat herself. This is my observation. It is in controversy with Clint Hill's explanation, but you can clearly see Clint Hill, who ends up on top of that limousine as it's going to Parkland. So, on the way to the hospital, you got seven passengers, technically, all together. Okay.
Okay. Brilliant. Thanks for that, Chuck. And Jack's just chipped in with, he's saying that the most medical professional witnesses say that the shot entered in the right occipital lobe. Now, does that affect where the shot came from?
Well, the occipital and parietal portion of the skull, generally we're mapping the skull. Mm-hmm. The brain disappeared.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're mapping the skull because we have x-rays and we have many witnesses that that did examine the skull, and we're trying to mitigate that damage. Entry and exit at the time, from the people who had their hands on the body, was not very clear because we had a completely shattered side of the head, and the rest of it was sort of, let me make this comparison, a hard-boiled egg. When you roll it across the counter, the shell is completely cracked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This is basically the condition of the skull.
Okay. I apologize. I read Jack's question wrong there. He said it exited, not entered. Sorry for that, Jack.
Okay, well, there's been a lot of question about exit and entry. As I said, you know, I've talked to Cyril Wecht. I've talked to one of the people who actually conducted the official autopsy, and I've talked to a couple of the Dallas doctors. Best I understand is that they believed that it did enter from the rear. Based on what they were looking at. But they were trying to reconstruct a skull, and they were utilizing techniques to make that determination. For instance, beveling in a skull bone was thought to be the one way to determine directionality, exit and entry on a skull at that time. And for many years, for the next, 40 years, that was generally accepted in forensic medicine. This has been discounted now, and the technique has changed. And we didn't even know this until 2003 that this was going to come about, because they found out that it's not necessarily positive or dispositive proof, the beveling itself. There's more aspects to this. I'm not a forensic expert, but I've talked to a lot of them. And I will tell you that when they're confronted with the conclusions, like I said, that Sherry Feaster has come up with, that the entry is somewhere in the, let's put it this way, the tangential part of the forehead in that area,
mm-hmm.
that's where your entry is.
Right.
On the headshot. Yes.
Okay.
But this occipital, parietal, all this kind of discussion has to do with the Harper fragment and the disposition of the skull afterwards. And first of all, the examination was crap. The memorialized information for the autopsy report was crap. It's literally one of the worst. It is even Michael Bodden, who was an apologist for the Warren Commission's conclusions and was on the House Select Committee in the 1970s, said that that legal medical autopsy was the exemplar of horrible work in forensic medicine. So what we have left without exhuming the body to take another look, what we have from the x-rays and the stuff that, quite honestly, the world public has not seen the total of the medical evidence. It's still held under special permission at the National Archives. But the stuff that has leaked out, the stuff that we do know, the stuff that was displayed and declassified in different ways, and the accidental production from James K. Fox's copy of the autopsy photos, which are real, guess what? We have a shot from the front to the head. Now, as far as the body and the neck, I contend that we're looking at three shots, although I can absolutely verify two. I think we're looking at three shots to Kennedy's body, but that's a whole other subject.
Okay, thanks for that, Chuck. And we've got one slipped in by Kevin, a cheeky little one there. He says, what about the wink that LBJ got when he was sworn in on the plane?
Ah, that could have been
wink.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was wink, that, wasn't it?
Yes, wink.
Wink, okay, all right, yeah. Carry on, Chuck.
Well, there's a series of photographs where LBJ's being sworn in. They're iconic at this point. Most of the public has not seen all of those photographs, although in recent years people have made a big deal out of it. And LBJ is probably making all kinds of, facial expressions at that point. It's hard to say what that really means. Here's an interesting thought, though. That entire presenting to the public that LBJ had been sworn in, the process of swearing him in as the next president and all this other stuff, was completely unnecessary. The moment that John F. Kennedy was declared dead, Lyndon Baines Johnson became president of the United States.
Doesn't he still have to swear the oath of office, though?
No, you don't.
No?
All right.
No.
You become the president, period. The moment the man is incapacitated or dead, the vice president becomes the president. And he's already taken an oath of office. There's a vice president's oath of office, too. He's already taken an oath of office, which is very similar. It's not necessary. It was not legally required. So it was a demonstration. It was something that was done for PR.
Basically. It was a ritual.
Yeah, it was a ritual, right.
So there's a question I'd like to ask you, Chuck, and it's something I've looked at quite a bit, and the switching of the bodies on the plane, how do you think that actually happened? He was swapped with the police officer's body?
No. We have found that there has been a huge difference between the observations on the body in Dallas and the observations on the body at Bethesda Medical, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for years and years, there was a guy named David Lifton who produced a book called Best Evidence and a documentary as well, who makes the case that body alteration must have occurred. It's easily solvable. Once somebody, even the whole thing with the casket and the body bag, and why is he coming in a different box, and all this other stuff, a little bit of logic, a little bit of patience, and we can solve it. Now, surgical alteration was witnessed by people from the funeral home. It was witnessed at Bethesda Medical, though.
Mm-hmm.
There's a doctor before the autopsy is even being conducted utilizing a bone saw on Kennedy, and who knows what other tools, okay? This is in the record now with the Assassination Records Review Board, although the Assassination Records Review Board was not designed to be an investigative agency. They were just verifying evidence, and they came up with that. We have alteration there. We have a possible switching of the body from one container to another based on a very simple thing. You couldn't get that big old casket through a particular door. Did they still bring the casket in and treat it honorably and all that and bring it into the autopsy area? Yeah. Yeah. And years later, Robert Kennedy had it dumped at sea, by the way, in secret by the Navy, to make sure that none of that stuff would be kept around. You know, because to this day, it's an interesting point that the chair that Lincoln's brains were spilled on is still on display somewhere. So, there's a lot of interesting rabbit trails again. But, no, I don't, I'm not of the mind that the body was switched or that that's J.D. Tippit or any of that. And you can take a look at J.D. Tippit's legal medical autopsy and just compare the dimensions. It doesn't work. Photographically, you couldn't have even possibly pulled that off. The photographs are another issue, of course. You know, is the record complete? Probably not. Is it completely honest? Absolutely not. Is it fabricated? I don't believe so. But anyway, there you go.
Well, that's pretty much covered my questions and the viewers' questions. I don't know if you've got anything else, Jason, or if we'd like to give the rest of the show over to Chuck to cover anything that he hasn't already covered that he'd like to.
Well, I think Kim, the point I'd like to make is that all this body removing and you know all this sort of stuff. The actual fact is that John Kennedy could not leave Dallas alive. That was the point of the entire thing. Now, all the rest of it is just sort of dressing up around it, isn't it? It's just about who did it, and it's all about muddying the waters just as much as getting towards the truth as well. Because there are many of these scenarios and situations, but once you get into the whole story and you see the amount of offshoots that it goes on to... that also tie into today's events. So I think rather than people trying to fake a death or something like that or do something, I think that the actual fact was that they could not have John Kennedy leave Dallas alive.
Well, right. And again, my supposition personally is that because he had challenged the CIA, because he had challenged those that benefit from the manufacture of weapons of war and, in fact, the industry of warfare itself, the fact that he had done that, that is why he needed to be removed. People often talk about, and I'll address one more mythological thing, people often talk about his challenge of the Fed. All right? Now, the Federal Reserve and these silver certificates and U.S. notes and what he was doing, he was issuing constitutional money. It's a fallacy. When you look at the order that people try and, you know, explain to you was his executive order, which was 11110, actually, that's not what he was doing. The mechanism continued to be printed all the way to 1971 and was actually utilized for the control of silver at that time and for decades previously by other administrations. However, was he looking to do something like audit the Fed? Yeah, when you go to take a look at stuff at the Presidential Library, you'll find that plans were underway to take a look at that, to actually begin to examine it. Okay? And it is the things that we don't know yet that may cause us to have a great many more suspects as time goes on. Mm-hmm. But I think we're being distracted from the reality in a lot of cases by the convenient story. And this is certainly the case with that particular myth. I say this, though. We do have the opportunity to satisfactorily answer the question that everybody always asks, which is, who did it? And I want to thank you guys for not asking that question of me, because everybody does, and it comes down to, I can't definitively tell you. I can only tell you I've got a short list of suspects, and I know what kind of jobs they did and what kind of people they worked for. But the exact shooters and the exact plotters are still not quite in our grasp just yet. Doesn't mean that it's impossible, because a hell of a lot of good work has been done. And I think with all things, we have the ability to and the right to know the history that has been thrust upon us. So there you go.
So, well, what I wanted to mention to you as well, Chuck, is I just wanted to say, don't... You know, when you talk about these myths, there are myths surrounding JFK and the assassination and what happened. Don't think that they... Even if those, in your opinion, are myths, don't you think that they have a value, because then they get people at least looking into the issue itself and investigating it? And even if they come across these myths and then they dispel them as myths, it sparked their interest and it's made them question more.
Well, all right. Here's the problem. If you go off on these different things that don't have tangible, reliable evidence, that don't have a logical conclusion to them, if you don't spend all that time, you might actually spend time on the things that'll lead somewhere. New evidence can emerge, that's true, but I don't think that all of these things that, you know, fall apart upon close examination are actually worthy of examination. No, I don't, because it's a big, huge time waster.
Do you not believe that if that leads them onto something else that is tangible, that doesn't have a value then?
Well, no. I think it actually is the diversion. It keeps you away from doing the good work. I mean, at one point, I'll tell you the worst myth that I believed in for a while. That was the whole French gunman concept. And that was early on in my examination. Okay? And it looked very tangible. It looked very reasonable. But it fell apart when you actually got deep into it, and I spent a couple of years on that. Now, if I had spent those couple of years understanding better covert operations, if I had spent those couple of years understanding what was actually going on in the administration to see exactly what he was doing, instead of looking at, you know, French connection-linked heroin dealers, well, I might have gotten a hell of a lot more done, Andy.
But Jason,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. But all I'm saying is that you said you spent a couple of years going down a route that was inevitably a dead end and wasn't right. But still before us, we have one of the greatest JFK researchers. And so do you not think that to keep your interest, that the value was in there? All I'm saying is, I'm not saying that people should believe these things. It's just that if that's a way in for people who then become, understand and perhaps research and become aware in a way that you are, do you not think that is, you know, valuable? That's the only point I'm making.
No, I object to it, because, again, people become very married to their theory. Once they find a couple of pieces of evidence, not too many people are insane enough to dig as deeply as some of us do, because it requires a lot of time. It requires a lot of effort. And they start to dig on it, and they find a couple of things that seem to make decent linkage, and they stick to it. And they ever after parrot it. And it becomes something larger than just a curiosity and a way in. And that's the thing. The distraction works to keep us occupied with Santa Claus brings us Christmas presents, you know? It really does. And that's not the truth. It's that simple, you know? So I'd rather put these things aside as opposed to embracing them and trying to warn people that since I've already gathered that knowledge and others have already gathered that knowledge to disprove this, let's go on the avenues that still need further research, that still need further examination, that still need that one person who's going to spend the next couple of years sifting through everything to find that one shred that pulls that string out. Why have them involved in stuff that you know is going to collapse of its own weight if you can have them doing the good work?
Yeah, I get where you're coming from to an extent there, Chuck, because I've witnessed that myself with other aspects of research. You get someone who comes across some information when they first start looking at that you or I may have looked at 5 or 10 years ago, and they like you say, they form their theory based around this obviously false evidence if you've had the time looking at it. But because they based it on those false premises, they become very entrenched in their attitudes. And I sometimes find myself wishing, well, I almost wish you'd never looked until we could kind of get this cleaned up a bit better for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you see it in all these different aspects of things that one could research and delve into, that's for sure. And I just would rather save people the time as best I can and let others tell you, look, you know, you could examine the Oswald case if you want all day long, and you need to understand what's happening, but don't get married to it, you know. That's the thing. If you want to examine these other theories, sure, you can learn how false theories are constructed if you want, and maybe recognize them later when new ones come up. But unfortunately, people don't do that. They usually just marry themselves to something that makes vague sense, and that's the end of it. So, you know, with that, guys, I really have to run because I had a previous appointment.
No, that's absolutely fine. We've run a couple of minutes over, Chuck, and I really want to thank you for tonight. It's been absolutely fabulous, and I hope we've done a good job on marking the occasion, and I'm sure with your help, this podcast will get a lot of hits.
And meanwhile, of course, Andy, as I've told you several times, anytime you guys want me on, you know, we can revisit this, go over the questions that were missed, address anything that I've said, address whatever it is they want. Even today, the Los Angeles Times has a big story about Lee Harvey Oswald and what he had in his green book and all that stuff. You know, it's still going on, the investigation, the speculation, and the distraction from the reality is still happening. So at any time, you guys can have me back on, and we can go over this again. It doesn't have to be the anniversary. But with that, I'm going to go.
That's
and
great,
I really
Chuck.
Appreciate you guys having me on, and thanks so much, Andy and Jason both. And, of course, I always like to thank Tony while I'm on the air with you guys, because you know, Mr. Hurst is definitely somebody that I appreciate and is part of the reason why I'm connected to you guys. And I really, really do appreciate it, and I'm extremely grateful to have been on with you today.
Many thanks, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.
And I'd really urge anyone who hasn't come across Chuck before to check out his shows on theacellieffect.com for his archive, and also on AmericanFreedomRadio.com.
It's just Ocelli.com, not the Ocelli. The Ocelli Effect, they're trying to sell to me at an exorbitant rate, but Ocelli.com just is my website.
My apologies, Chuck. Yeah, I did see you actually had the American peace flag on there one day the other week. That was quite something to see. We don't see that very often.
The civil flag, yes. Mm. Anyway, please, by all means, check me out there on Raconteurs News. I'm replayed, and apparently I'm part of Autonomous Media now as well, and I'm grateful for all of that, guys, and who knows what'll come in 2017. Anyway, have a good night.
Thank you very much, Chuck, and good night. I hope all our listeners found that as interesting and enlightening as I'm sure Jason has, and I definitely have. That was an absolutely fabulous show. We're going to wrap it up now.
Yeah, great show, that one. Yeah, good show.
Yeah, unless you've got any last little tidbits, I guess we better wrap it up, Jason.
Yeah, Yeah, I think we should. Hopefully next week, bit of good news regarding somebody who I'm helping out at the moment who's not going through a very good time at all, but you stick in there, Rebecca, and we'll have you as good as new as soon as possible.
Okay, yeah, our love goes out to Rebecca, and hope things improve for you very soon, and I'm sure if you've got Jason on your side, they certainly will. Thanks for listening, everyone, because as I've said so many times before, without us, without you, we'd be just talking to ourselves. We're back next week, same time, same place. We're on autonomousmedia.net, and for a little while longer, we're on raconteursnews.com. But if you could check out Autonomous Media, we do need to test the site as much as possible. So if you could get on there, that'd be a real help. And yeah, many thanks to Tony. He's been working the clock round getting this sorted. Done a fabulous job. There's a couple of little glitches in there, but if you get any glitches, please report them to an admin, and we'll do our best to have them ironed out as soon as possible. When we're back next week, we will be joined by, this is a good one, we've got a Slovenian hemp farmer lined up, so we'll be talking about all things Slovenian hemp. So, yeah, it'd be good, wouldn't it? So, thanks for that, folks. We're going to play you out with this Homer Henderson song. Lee Harvey was a friend of mine. Good night, take care, and we'll see you next week.
Take it easy.
Lee Harvey was a friend of mine. They say he shot the president. I don't think he did. And Lee Harvey was a friend of mine. He used to take me fishing all the time. He used to throw the ball to me when I was just a kid. They say down, murdered by Jack Ruby, the biggest sleaze in town. He stuck that gun into his ribs and said, "Here's looking at you, kid." Ruby killed Lee Harvey, TV proved he did.
And Lee Harvey.
They shot the president. I don't.